From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast.
This is MC Fontaine, welcoming you to another Bletchley Park podcast extra. This is the second and final part of the talk given at Bletchley Park by Martin Davidson, as he finds out more secrets from his grandfather's past, discovering the perfect Nazi.
So I then, over a number of years, tried to find out what it was that he'd actually done. And what I would discover about his career was that the SS part of his career is Act Three. This is the final thing. And I thought, where I thought my researches was going to take me, it was going to culminate in some unspeakable Polish forest in 1943, and him with some unthinkable smoking gun nightmare. But before I could get there, what I realised in researching was, as I said in the reading, how far back it went. There was an Act One and an Act Two to his story. And at that point, I became very interested to discover, where does somebody like that come from? How does this stuff begin? Because the appalling realisation I came to, by 1942, you're in the German army. All bets are off by then. They've invaded the Soviet Union. They're in the middle of a completely explicit war of annihilation in the Eastern Front. So any question you're asking about morality or rationale is just gone by that point. The war has dictated. But what about 1924, when none of this is apparent? What happens to the mind of a 16, 17, 18-year-old that makes them make that decision that this is the politics for them? And when I went back, I discovered a gold honour party badge. Again, if any of you remember Schindler's List, at the end of the film, Oskar Schindler collapses at the end with regret that he didn't manage to sell. He takes that badge off. So if only I'd sold it, I could have saved another few lives. Now, historically, that is complete solecism, a complete mistake for one very simple reason. There is no way Oskar Schindler would have been given that badge. You didn't just buy them, you earned them, and you earned them in one very specific way. You had to have a party number of under 100,000. If you think by 1935-36, the Nazi Party membership stands at around 5 million, you can imagine how early you would have had to have joined in order to... And I asked a German historian, I said, so that badge... what privileges did it entitle you to? And he said, oh, you'd have worn that badge front row of every meeting. Everyone would have spotted that was the ultimate trophy of a long-term committed Nazi ideologue. That was your reward for being what they called an Erlkämpfer, an old struggler. You were part of the early part of the movement, which Hitler was always very sentimental about. Stalin wasn't. I remember asking another German historian, I said, if you had to make history's most difficult decision, work for Hitler or Stalin, he said, work for Hitler any day of the week. He wouldn't turn around and shoot you just because he could. Stalin would. So that was a badge laden with a lot of very sentimental kudos, very proudly worn. And what I discovered was he had a party number of 36,000. It's a small football crowd. So in 1926, he joined the party, born in 1906, so he's 19, 20 years old, and he does an extraordinary thing on that day. May 1926, he joins two organisations. We've got his party card, written Gothic copper plate. So he joins the party, and he joins the SA, the brown shirts, on the same day, which, to my mind, is a sort of an extraordinary double commitment. This is, not only do I believe in everything that this politics stands for, I'm going to become, as well as being a dentist, which is my day job, I will march the streets in uniform, helping pave the way for power at a point when we're a tiny fringe group. The right wing in Germany is a lot of, it's a splinter group of lots of mad people on the lunatic fringes of the right wing, all preaching all of this nationalist stuff. And he's chosen that. And in a funny sort of way, I was almost more shocked to discover that than I was that he'd been in the SS. There's a bit of me, as I say, by 1940, what do you think he was in? And then we discovered that he had, in 1924, joined an organisation called the Front Barn. So in 1924, Hitler's just out of prison after the beer hall putsch of 1923. So he is a complete political nobody. He has no power or credibility or influence or profile whatsoever. He's just a loudmouth from Munich who's just been released from prison, ranting on street corners. And his great right-hand man, Ernst Röhm, a World War I veteran who is the man who creates the paramilitaries. And Ernst Röhm's job is to... he provides the muscle for Hitler's politics. Hitler's vision for himself is as a politician, not a soldier. So it's very interesting that most of the senior Nazis after World War I were all members of what was called the Freikorps. So these are people in 1919, 1920, who've come back brutalised, angry, thuggish from World War I, convinced they haven't been defeated. And they're the ones who keep their arms and they form regiments, and their job, they take it on themselves to patrol the streets of Munich and Berlin shooting communists, because there are communist uprisings in the cities of Germany. And Himmler was in one, Heydrich was in one. Most of the older senior Nazis were in the Freikorps. Hitler wasn't, interestingly. And I think the reason for that was that he, from very early on, the really frightening thing about Hitler was that he felt motivated not by straightforward lust for violence. He's not Mussolini. What he is a man who thinks he has an idea. Much more terrifying. If you take the word party, the party, before World War I, it's a meaningless word. It conjures up pictures of men in top hats, sending each other telegrams, quietly organising the business of Europe. Maybe they're a liberal, maybe they're a Tory, maybe they're a Whig. It doesn't really matter. It's all the same class of patrician men doing business. After the war, both in the Russian context and the German context, the word party means something altogether different. So I think one of the important things to discover that helps explain Brunner's story is that the whole meaning of what politics is has changed. And that after the war, it becomes the repository for the most violent, aggressive and terrifying ideas it's capable for humanity to hold. And the other thing about politics is it will brook no dissent. The thing about politics is it's bigger than human beings. You are not as important as the political program. Much more frightening than simply to be at the mercy of a godfather thug or a brute who is violent and intimidating or psychopathic. It was the nature of the idea. And for Hitler, the idea was that the world was being fought for by three or four competing forces. In Russia, it was class. The Marxist struggle in Russia was the dictatorship of the proletariat. It was a vision that would rule the world by class. In America, it was money. In Southern Europe, it was the Catholic Church. And in Germany, it was race. And what Hitler promised was a politics of race, which is that if you understand what sets us Germans, Aryans, white North European Anglo-Saxons apart from the rest, you will draw strength from that and justification to redraw the world in its image. That's all the justification we will need. One of the things I did in preparing this book was I went and read Mein Kampf. It's really, oh, I was going to say interesting. Of course it's not interesting. It's an appalling thing to do, but most people write Mein Kampf off as being the deranged rantings of a lunatic, and it's unreadable. Everyone will tell you it's gibberish, it's doggerel, and don't give it a minute's thought. And it is, all that's true. But the thing that comes out of it, nevertheless, when you read it, and two things happened to me when I read it. One was this idea emerged. I could hear the voice, and it was his voice. Utter certainty. There are two sides. Everything is black and white, and what you do is white annihilates black. And what you get is Hitler emerges from these pages. I am a political titan. I am a visionary. And I am the force around which you follow me and I will deliver you a world built around my concept of race, at the top of which will be the German Superman. And opposed to it is, of course, the image of the Jew and the Untermensch. The thing about German racism, Nazi racism, that's really terrifying is they had two levels of racism. They shared, as did the British Empire, a pretty unhealthy view that the brown peoples of the world were not as deserving of a place in the sun as the white European. Their view of that was the attitude they had to the Slavs, to the East Europeans. But over and above that, there was another even more pernicious layer of human judgment, which was about the Jews. And they were the enemy behind the enemy. And that's why German racism is both thuggish and brutal, but then all superpower empires have thuggish and brutal racial attitudes to those peoples they subjugate. But the German is even more terrifying because over that, they think there's a science at work. There's a science that means that the whole Jewish question merits a whole level of investigation, expertise, and solution, which ordinary racism isn't equipped to deal with. And there's a terrifying thing all the way through the way the Germans speak, which is all the way through this period, there is reserved for the Jews that they deserve a more scientific understanding than mere street brawling. They have no time for ordinary anti-Semites who give Germany a bad name. Because actually, at the heart of Hitler's ideas about the world and about race is this extraordinary picture that the world is involved in this fight between the powers of German supermen and a world dominated by Moscow and Wall Street. And Moscow and Wall Street are both, in the eyes of a kind of pathological psychopath like Hitler, are both dominated by Jews. And what you get in Mein Kampf is that the idea at the heart of all of this appalling stuff is that there's no contradiction between a person who is both a Wall Street capitalist and a Red Square communist. They're the same person, because lying behind it is this great global conspiracy. They're the invisible levers of power. They're the real racial enemy. And what I began to realise was that is what, I'm afraid, and it's just an appalling thing to realise, was that what took Bruno into the Nazi Party was at some level he must have believed all that. He must have thought, yes, that makes sense to me. You're absolutely right. A way of explaining the world has to do with the hidden levers of power operated by communists in Moscow and capitalists in Wall Street, and they're the same people. So I was expecting to find somebody who was motivated, as a lot of Germans were, by simply getting ahead. This is, you know, by 1934, you have to join the party to get ahead. And what I realised was even worse in him was, yes, he was certainly first in the queue for all the rewards and prizes that the Third Reich offered its chosen elite. But he was a man operating entirely out of conviction, which is why I think the Third Reich, what it has to tell you, is much less than simply what kind of madman was Hitler, and far more about the power of a pernicious idea. So I discovered then that what Bruno had done was he had joined the SA, and his commitment to the movement was such that he was prepared to spend 9 years, essentially from 1924 until Hitler's in power, being one of those people who provide muscle and fist to help pave the way for power, because it's one thing Hitler understood brilliantly. You tell one lot of Germans that you stand for respectability and law and order and national prestige, and you tell another lot of Germans, which is get out in the streets and beat up people who are in your way. And Bruno performs that role. He's a street-fighting thug in the SA, marching up and down the streets of North Berlin in his brown shirt. Characters, if you've ever seen the movie Cabaret, there's that moment when brown shirts suddenly appear and you know that's it, civilization is now over. But the really interesting thing that he did is in 1937, he makes the transition. He moves from the SA to the SS. And I think that was a very, very significant decision that he made. Because what he realised, and again, it's quite a frightening thing to understand, is that at every point that the Nazi Party's grip on Germany grew deeper and more secure, Bruno would reinvent himself time and time again to place himself even more at its disposal. His story is a series of self-reinventions. He's forever weighing up, where am I in the power grid? What more do I now need to do? And he's very, very clever at it. It's why at the beginning of this talk I used the word curriculum vitae. That's what it is. It's as calculated as anyone working their way through a corporation. It's all about questionnaires, resumes, CVs, lobbying the right people. When you look at his record and you take all the Nazi stuff out of it, it's not that different from working your way through any organisation. But in 1937, I think something really frightening happens, which is what I meant at the beginning when I said he represents the kind of person who I think historians haven't bothered to explore very much, which is the invisible enablers, the upper middle managers, without whom this would all have fizzled out. By 1937, Germany has grown pretty much reconciled to having Hitler. Most Germans don't like the Nazis, but they like Hitler. And what they like is employment. They like the fact that antisocial elements have been swept off the streets. They're not too fussy about who those people were. The left wing has been completely eradicated. If you're a price-gouging landlord who is preying on innocent, wholesome German flat dwellers, a few months in a concentration camp will sort them out. They're building autobahns. The rest of the world now acknowledges, including Churchill, that Germany is now in the hands of a serious global statesman who deserves respect. But then something terrible happens in 1937, and I think it's no coincidence that that's the moment that Bruno joins the SS. As you probably know in the history of it, the brown shirts, they're the people who provide the Nazis with the presence on the streets, and they're doing all the unpleasant, the bullying, the thuggery, sweeping people up off streets, detaining them illegally in improvised prisons. They are the strong arm of the movement. But as anyone who knows the period knows, in 1934, Hitler has a decision to make. Do I support the radical 3 million people in the SA, or do I have the army on my side? The army tell him, we're not giving up any power to the SA, you sort them out, and it creates the Night of the Long Knives, where 200 senior SA people, including Ernst Röhm, the head of the SA, are murdered. And that's Hitler's way of telling the German people, I've curbed my own rabble-rousers, and I'm now a man of respect. And the people, of course, who benefit most from that are the SS. Now, the SS are a completely different order of terror organisation. The SA, they're fat, beer-swilling bullies. But the SS are terrifying. And the reason they're terrifying is because of Himmler. And what Himmler understands is that what you do to make Hitler's vision for the future of Germany work is you don't ever ask him explicitly what he wants, because he'll never tell you. But what you do is you infer from Hitler, if you like, the unsayable becomes the unspeakable. And Himmler is a genius at it, and he pledges ideological, sort of extraordinary levels of political loyalty to Hitler and promises to do three things that Hitler is still obsessed, have not been done. By 1937, most Germans think it's enough. Brilliant. Sad about democracy going, sad about the Weimar Republic, but it was a deal with the devil worth doing. And none of them want war. Nobody in Germany in 1937 wants there to be a war. They're terrified by this prospect of it. But for Hitler, there are three bits of business yet to be attended to. One is, there is a small matter of revenge for World War I. Britain and France need taking down a peg or two. He hasn't forgotten. You may have. He hasn't. Secondly, Lebensraum. Russia, actually, I've been writing about it since Mein Kampf. I mean it. We should have a large continental land empire. I wasn't bluffing. And just because you've got your autobahns and your full employment, don't think you're going to squirm out of that. And the third is, we've still got Jews in Germany. And the one organisation had come along and said, we will help you with all three, with the SS. And that required a new level of even more ideological commitment, even more enthusiasm for everything that Hitler stood for, which is why they become the driving force in all that is to happen later. And the question I had to work out was, so he's in the SS, and I then discovered he's not just in the SS, he's in the SD, the Sicherheitsdienst. The Sicherheitsdienst is a small, 200 of them, not very many in the early stages, set up under Heydrich, who's then assassinated in 1942 in Prague. And Heydrich is even more terrifying than Himmler. And he sets up the SD with two jobs. One is spying, espionage, surveillance, of course, counter-espionage. And second is, of course, the Holocaust. Eichmann works for the SD, and it is the most prestigious job that a Nazi organisation could have. Will we be the ones to spearhead the racial war that's coming? And the SD becomes an elite within an elite. And I realised that Bruno's in it. They had a lozenge-shaped badge on their things saying SD. The Gestapo, the secret police, belonged to the state. They were the political secret police. But the SD were the Nazi secret police. But in time, they would have huge arguments with the Abwehr. One of the great things about Bletchley Park was it stands for a unified, coordinated intelligence effort that the Allies had that the Germans, luckily for us, did not have. All their intelligence efforts were hugely fragmented and squandered because each of the rival organisations fought each other. So Brunner's in that organisation. What I had to find out was in which guise. He's joined the SD, and it's one of two answers. He's either part of the camp system or he's a spook. And it turns out, until I find evidence to the contrary, he's a spook. He's working in Office 6, and he's working for a man called Walter Schellenberg, who is a rather sort of semi-comic figure, really. He's the man who writes the book about what Germany will do with Britain once we've been conquered. And he writes a whole list, because he fancies himself as an Anglophile expert, and he has some very bizarre ideas about who the key people in Britain are and what Britain will be like once it's invaded. So that was the end of the quest. And so what I had discovered in this man, my grandfather, was a career spent walking lockstep with the wider movement. He, if you like, was a miniature embodiment of the wider story. So at every key point when the Nazi story changes, so did he. So what I ended up trying to describe was a man, if you like, he's a microcosm for the wider story, which I thought in the end was rather chilling and rather interesting to see that happen in a man, you know, particularly in the fact that it has this denouement, which is that he survives. And the thing I find so ironic was he dies a year after the Berlin Wall comes down. He gets to see the final act in the story, played the long game, and he saw it all, and went to his grave knowing that once upon a time he'd been a very important man, and he never, ever loosened his grip on how much pride that gave him. And I remember when I was asking my mother, I thought, well, you know, what do you remember? She had no use at all for any information about what regiment was he in. She had no insight into any of that. So I turned the question round. I thought, you know what, the one thing about children, even when you're seven, is you have a pretty good sense of where your parents feature in the scheme of things. You may not know the detail of their jobs. So I remember asking her, so was he an important man? And before she could stop herself, she said, oh, yes, very important man. A motorbike used to come round every evening with papers for him to sign. And before she then shut up. What I wanted to do was offer a description of what it was I thought I was writing. Why did I do this? Some people have accused me, you may well do, this is dirty laundry. What on earth are you doing writing this in public? I would say, very interestingly, none of my families or my own Jewish friends have a single problem with this. I've given talks like this at the Wiener Library. Quite a few of my mother's German friends certainly do. They're very, very angry with me for having broken ranks. Very interesting. And my mother is endlessly telling me, oh, you know, another one of her older friends of a certain age suddenly going, well, how could you have let him do it? It's a disgrace. Very interesting. It actually makes me more determined to have written it. But the last thing I would say is, I think in the justification for writing a book that's uncomfortable and, yes, I mean, somebody wants it to be, well, you know, all worked very for you. You're just cashing in on his notoriety. I understand the Nazi story has a kind of black fascination around it. You can overindulge in it. I know that. But for me, the difference is between private knowledge and secret knowledge. And what I've tried to write, I've tried to uncover and bring into daylight secrets. This is not a private life. These are not private things. And the last justification I have for it was, if the Germans had won, he'd have been shouting about his life from the rooftops. The only reason they were secret is because he lost. And my justification is that's not the same thing as being voyeuristic about somebody's private life. These were secrets. And I think in a tiny, small way, from my own point of view, I'm glad his story is there for anyone to have a look at and see if there's anything of historical value to draw from it about what it tells you about how these things work, how they happen. All you can do to be forearmed the next time something like this happens is to have a good eye for what the symptoms are, what people start sounding like when these kind of ideas start taking root. Anyway, that was it, the perfect Nazi. I'm very happy to take questions if anyone wants to have comments or throw things back at me.
What was he in the SD?
He had two jobs. He started off doing a thing called Berlin Inspekteur. So he worked for the local office that kept tabs on the ultra-non-Nazi right wing. Only opposition they had. They didn't care about the left wing. They were eradicated. What they cared about was what are the other right-wing groups, the monarchists. The right wing in Germany at this period, they were called the Reaktion, R-E-A-K-T-I-O-N. And the only opposition that Hitler really feared was army, the landed aristocracy, the captains of industry, all of whom had right-wing notions which weren't necessarily Nazi. So he would survey them because he knew them all. So he was keeping tabs on them. But at the end of the war in Prague, he was there for a year at the end of the war, he would have been involved in anti-partisan activities because Czechoslovakia was full of parachuters. And we did find records. He was setting up werewolf groups who were going to carry on the fight after defeat. So by that point, he was actually turned out to be a rather inept radio operator, setting up secret networks.
Has your mother read the book?
No. No. No, interestingly, she went on her own journey with it. Was she started off being absolutely anguished about it. And what I realised was, the reason for that was that he didn't care about any of this. They were the secret keepers, not him. They were the ones who put up the firewall, walked on eggshells. And when I showed her, I said, look, every key moment in this man's life, he had a decision to make. Either the family or his Nazi career, and he chose his Nazi career every single time, and something broke her, and she said, oh, well, to hell with him. To hell with him. I've been protecting his reputation for 50 years. Why? But that hasn't yet translated into reading it. She said, I just find it too upsetting.
Presumably you did a lot of archival research. What was the sort of accessibility?
Amazing. Berlin Document Centre is where all the SS party records are kept. There was a slightly wobbly moment after German reunification, because it used to be run by the Americans. And they handed it back to the Germans, who instantly instituted rules saying, you have to have permission of the person you're investigating before we're allowed in. But that rule got scotched. And I thought, yeah, I'll bet you do. But luckily, of course, the reason they couldn't do it is the Americans have a sister version of all on microfiche in Maryland, outside Washington. So there's no point, because you just do it there. And all the other archive stuff I got was Washington, Landsberg and Prague. And what I did was, I don't speak Czech. The secret to all of this is you talk to a really good couple of professors and you get bright PhD students who are desperate for a bit of money. And also they know, because the professors, they haven't been in archive for 30 years. And I had three very, very good PhD students, a Czech who's writing a thesis about Theresienstadt, who knew the archives brilliantly, and a British guy based at UCL, and somebody in America, and we did it that way. And a brilliant guy in Berlin who had done a thesis on the rise of the SA in Berlin between 1926 and 1933, and he had, in his own research, two or three allusions to 26-year-old Lunkbein, Bruno, but it was fragments. What I got was fragments. It was a scrap here and a scrap there. So what you do is you get your eye in, you start getting a sense of small fragments adding up.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening. Why not follow our channel on Audioboo, where you can also subscribe to the RSS feed, or you can subscribe to us in iTunes. You can follow us on Twitter, where we're at @BPartPodcast, or join the Bletchley Park Facebook group. And of course, we must thank Audioboo, who make this podcast possible.